J'ai le grand plaisir d'accueillir à présent le professeur Matthew Fraley de l'université Brandeis, qui est bien sûr très connu dans nos études japonaises et de Kambun. Il est spécialiste de littérature classique et moderne. Il a beaucoup travaillé sur la littérature en sino-japonaise, qu'il a contribué à populariser sous le nom de Cinetic, je crois. je ne sais pas si nous reviendrons sur ça. Et de l'époque d'Edo et de Meiji. Et il a aussi développé une réflexion tout à fait intéressante. Je ne sais pas si nous pourrons en parler aujourd'hui ou demain à propos de la lecture en kundoku des langues européennes au Japon, qui est un sujet très intéressant et qui peut être aussi comparé à certaines pratiques médiévales européennes. Aujourd'hui, il va nous parler de quelque chose qui va bien s'harmoniser avec la conférence suivante. Sound and Sense, Linguistic Consciousness in Japanese Remarks on Poetry. Professeur, allez, je laisse parler.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to start off by thanking Professor Robert for the very kind invitation to come and speak here. It's quite an honor. As Professor Robert said, the title of my talk is Sound and Sense, Linguistic Consciousness in Japanese Remarks on Poetry. I think it is fair to say that sound is fundamental to most definitions of poetry. Many literary commentators have located poetry's distinctiveness in the combined importance it places upon both sound and sense. In his introductory text, Poetry the Basics, for example, British poet and translator Geoffrey Wainwright begins by observing how quickly and immediately young learners can derive pleasure from the rhyme and rhythm of poetic language, pointing out what he sees as the crucial role that sound, timing, and rhythm play in the making of poetry. Wainwright concludes, quote, "Poetry works on the ear. It is a form developed for and in performance within a long oral tradition." Or in his widely used literary theory, A Very Short Introduction, the American literary scholar Jonathan Culler writes, quote, "Literature is language that foregrounds language itself. In particular, poetry organizes the sound plane of language so as to make it something to reckon with." But what about poetry written in a language by those who do not speak it? How should we understand the aural dimensions of such poetic traditions if they were not exactly heard in the conventional sense by their composers? Like their counterparts elsewhere in the Sinosphere, composers of Sinitic poetry in early modern Japan were keenly attentive to prosodic rules, tonality, rhyme, and other features conventionally associated with aurality. Yet such aspects of a poem were usually inaudible in the dominant form of oral performance practiced in Japan at the time, interpretive recitation allowed by kundoku, a conventionalized form of gloss reading in which the literary Sinitic text was construed with the extensive use of Japanese Sino-Zenic or vernacular equivalents for each graph, often with additional grammatical markers, inflections, and syntactic rearrangement. Today, I would like to look at how Japanese theorists and practitioners of Sinitic poetry came to terms with this central issue in their writings, how to achieve euphony in poems written in a language that they did not speak. But even more fundamentally, we must ask, how did early modern Japanese poets conceive of the linguistic status of Sinitic texts? To be sure, the particular rhythms of Japanese kundoku recitation could themselves be the focus of creative attention on the part of poets, and appreciation on the part of listeners. But as we shall see, the specifics of Japanese recitational practice were not the principal concern of contemporary commentators on the sound of Sinitic poetry. They were almost without exception interested principally in questions that confronted all Sinospheric poets. In other words, these Japanese commentators discussed tonal prosody, rhyme, and other features of Sinitic texts in ways that engaged continental commentators, even though their own conclusions might diverge from them. This research is part of a larger project I've been working on recently that seeks to examine the ways in which Sinitic poetic composition was conceptualized and discussed by Japanese authors from the early modern to the modern period. In this project, I'm interested in very basic, but somewhat elusive questions. To put it most simply, what did Japanese practitioners of this time period think they were doing in writing Sinitic verse? How did they understand their project in relation to Japan's vernacular literary traditions? How did they situate Japan's Sinitic poetry with respect to Chinese forms and precedents? To what extent did they insinuate themselves into a broader regional frame? What, if anything, did they identify as specific to Japanese Sinitic poetry? How did their work contribute to the formation of a canon of Japanese Sinitic poetry? One of the main sources that I've been examining in the hope of addressing these sorts of questions is the large body of poetic treatises known as Shiwa, Remarks on Poetry or Poetry Talks. At the risk of stating the obvious, what Shi means here is not poetry in general, as it does today, but traditional Sinitic poetry specifically, the classical modes of expression with roots in ancient China that linked intellectuals throughout the Sinosphere into modern times. This kind of poetry is known in Japan today, of course, as kanshi. While this term, kanshi, is ubiquitous in both academic and popular usage in Japan as well as abroad, none of the poets I discuss today would have used the term kanshi to describe what they wrote. To all Japanese prior to the late 19th century, the Sinitic poems that they labored to create were simply shi, the same term by which they were known to other members of the Sinosphere. We should also bear in mind that neither the Japanese term shi nor the term that replaced it, kanshi, makes a distinction in terms of authorial nationality. Whether the Sinitic verses are composed by Japanese, Chinese, Koreans, Vietnamese, or others, they are all encompassed by the same term. In other words, the way that these terms have been historically and are still today used in Japanese differs from a common practice among Anglophone scholars. When Anglophone scholars write of kanshi, they almost always mean Chinese poems by Japanese composers specifically. But again, it is no trivial matter that the Japanese word kanshi, just like its predecessor shi, in fact refers to literary Sinitic poetry as a whole, regardless of authorial nationality. Though the term kanshi has become part of our collective common sense, it was only around the 1890s that the term came to be used widely. This mid-Meiji period shift was in part the natural outgrowth of a slightly earlier change wherein the word shi came to be used as a gloss of the English term poetry. One of the most influential texts that drove this shift in the very meaning of the term shi was Shintai Shisho, published in 1882. As you can see from the volume's introductory notes, the editors took pains to explain the new sense of poetry in general that they had assigned to the term shi in their work, and they made a point of distinguishing their novel use of shi from its traditional sense of Sinitic poetry. With the rapid dissemination of this broadened sense of the term shi, it became necessary to add the prefix kan in order to specifically designate Sinitic verse. Yet this change elicited strenuous objections from some Shiwa authors in their remarks on poetry. For example, in the mid-1890s, Noguchi Neisai, a Japanese poet who worked in Sinitic forms and wrote numerous guides for aspiring Japanese poets, wrote an angry dismissal of the recent neologism kanshi. In his Shounen Shiwa, Remarks on Poetry for Youthful Readers, he called the prefix kan a useless wart and beseeched his readers to not use the new term and to refer to Sinitic poetry instead by the traditional term shi. With apologies to Noguchi Neisai, I will occasionally use the word kanshi today for the sake of expedience. But whenever I do, I'd like you to imagine that it has an asterisk beside it or appears in scare quotes. This genre of shiwa flourished throughout East Asia, where the same Sinitic compound was pronounced as shiwa, shihua, or shihua. Typically written by a single author, these texts often quote specific works of Sinitic poetry and offer commentary, thus combining features of an anthology and a poetic treatise. The shiwa genre had its origins in China, where the term shihua first came to be used in the Song. Most scholars identify Ouyang Xiu's late 11th century Liuyizhu Shihua as the founding exemplar of the Shihua genre. It is the first text to have Shihua in its title. As we can see from this prefatory comment on the text, Ouyang Xiu wrote it after he went into retirement in Ruyin to provide fodder for relaxed conversation about poetry. Liuyizhu Shihua consists of short remarks on specific poems and poets woven together in a desultory following the brush, Swabian style. Though the precise number of sections depends on the edition, the text of Liu Yizhi Shihua gathers about 29 short units. This structure was an influential model throughout East Asia. 200 years later, the late Kamakura-era Zen priest Kokan Shiran wrote Saihoku Shiwa, the first Shiwa by a Japanese author. In addition to choosing to use the word Shiwa in his work's title, Kokan Shiran linked his text to Ouyang Xiu's foundational Liu Yizhi Shihua by making his own text consist of 29 units too. What is now considered the first Korean Shihua, Igyubo's 13th century Peigun Soso, likewise comprises 29 units. Kokan Shiren's early example notwithstanding, the Shiwa genre actually came to flourish in Japan many centuries later, during the mid to late Edo period, when Chinese exemplars such as Yenyu's Cangtang Shihua were reprinted, and Japanese Sinitic poets began to publish their own treatises in increasing numbers. Around 50 or 60 Japanese Shiwa from this period are widely known and easily accessible today. In his brief outline of Japanese Shiwa, Fujikawa Hideo identifies five categories. They are introductory works that address practical questions about the craft of Sinitic versification, tendentious works that argue for a particular vision of Sinitic poetic expression, works of annotation that explicate difficult phrases in Sinitic poetry, works that trace the history of Japanese Sinitic verse, and works that gather Sinitic verse from China and Japan and provide commentary upon it. Though they have received very little attention in Anglophone scholarship, several of these Shiwa were widely read and influential works in their time. Some of them were even at the very cutting edge of academic and cultural endeavor. One of the best known, for example, is Kikuchi Gozan's Gozando Shiwa, Gozando's Remarks on Poetry, which appeared in 15 volumes between 1807 and 1832. It exemplifies the fifth category in Fujikawa's typology of Japanese Shiwa, the combination anthology commentary. In his book-length study of this text, Gozando Shiwa, Ibi Takashi sees this serially published text as nothing less than Japan's earliest commercial periodical. He argues that inasmuch as it targeted a non-specific plurality of readers, was published at semi-regular intervals, contained contemporaneous information and criticism, and provided its editor with his main source of livelihood, Gozando Shiwa can reasonably be considered the first example of Japanese commercial journalism. Another innovative text, the exemplar of Fujikawa Hideo's fourth category of Japanese Shiwa, is Emura Hokkai's Nihon Shishi. Published in 1770, this five-volume work is not only the first history of Sinitic poetry in Japan, but also, in Ōtani Masao's estimation, the first full-fledged literary history to be published in Japan. In addition to identifying exemplary models of Sinitic verse, the authors of these various types of Japanese Shiwa devoted substantial attention to reflecting upon the nature of Sinitic poetic expression, its aims, and sometimes the particular challenges that Japanese poets faced. I said a few moments ago that one of the issues that Japanese Shiwa authors addressed was the question of how best to create euphonic poetry written in a language that they didn't speak. But how did they conceive of this language of literary Sinitic? Did they imagine themselves to be writing in some variety of Japanese? Or did they instead conceive of literary Sinitic fundamentally as a foreign language? This is a matter of some complexity and controversy. In recent years, a few Anglophone scholars, including prominent champions of greater attention to these materials, have stated that texts written in literary Sinitic were not considered foreign to non-Chinese Sinospheric practitioners until the modern period. They assert that it was only with the imposition of the modern framework of the nation-state that a consciousness of the language of Sinitic texts as foreign emerged. For example, Wiebke Dennecke writes, quote, "Most Japanese practitioners of kundoku were monolingual and did not conceive of Chinese texts as texts in a foreign language. Learning kundoku did not involve learning a foreign language, it simply required a certain kind of literacy training." David Lurie is more circumspect, acknowledging the existence of Ogyu Sorai and other Japanese commentators in the early modern period who clearly understood Sinitic as a foreign language, yet he also portrays such figures as a distinct minority that wrote what he dismisses as, quote, polemics. I can understand the motivation to make such claims. Denying the foreignness of Sinitic might seem a good way to counteract a major reason that such texts have historically been overlooked by those studying the national literary traditions of non-Chinese cultures in the Sinosphere. In the Japanese case, as the field of national literature took shape in the 1890s, the concept's phonocentric and monolingual underpinnings meant that sinographic texts were jettisoned from the canons of Japanese literature precisely because they were deemed foreign and therefore inauthentic, peripheral, or somehow lesser. But I think we must be very careful in specifying what we mean by foreign. I agree that many pre-modern and modern producers of sinographic texts in Japan did not regard such materials as foreign in the sense of irrelevant, alien, or unfamiliar. Clearly, sinographic texts were central to the learning and creative enterprise of many Japanese over the centuries. There is no doubt that Sinitic texts are an indispensable and vital part of the Japanese literary tradition. That's not in dispute. Yet it is problematic to imagine that traditionally educated Japanese readers lacked a fundamental awareness of literary Sinitic texts as being written in a foreign language, that is, a language originating outside of Japan that was governed by a syntax and grammar completely distinct from those of the local language and with an evolving lexicon intimately tied to its Chinese sources. In approaching this topic, we must be cautious not to let our zeal to counteract the historical rejection of these texts lead us into making assertions that are demonstrably incompatible with the historical understanding of Japanese practitioners of Sinitic poetry and prose. It is not uncommon to read modern Japanese commentators speak of the country's Sinitic literary traditions in terms that frame it as fundamentally an exophonic act, that is, an act of writing in a foreign language. In a collection of essays by prominent post-war scholars of Sinitic poetry from Japan's early modern period, published in 1986, for example, the eminent authority on Japanese literature of the period, Nakamura Yukihiko, observed that kanji was Japan's only widespread poetic form in which Japanese write in a foreign language as it is. He even compared this phenomenon to Russians of a certain age writing in French. Nakamura's statement clearly reveals his understanding of Sinitic as a foreign language for Japanese intellectuals. Is this conceptualization unique to present-day scholars operating under the national literature paradigm? Consider remarks made by Suzuki Torao, educated in Meiji, who went on to become a leading scholar of Chinese literature. Under the sobriquet Hyouken, Suzuki was a lifelong composer of Sinitic poetry, and in 1951 he contributed an essay to Gayu, a newly founded magazine for enthusiasts of Sinitic poetry. Dismayed by the decline of Sinitic literary production in post-war Japan, Suzuki stated that it was wrong to discard a practice just because it was foreign, before going on to argue that exophonic literary creation had certain benefits. Quote, "It is useful to put oneself in the position of writing from another country's vantage point." Suzuki Torao's appeal to the nation in this essay may make us wonder if his understanding is solely the byproduct of the modern framework of nation states. What about Japanese who came of age in the late Tokugawa period? The scholar, poet, and journalist Narushima Ryuhoku, who lived through the transition from Edo to Meiji, more than once spoke of the composition of kanji and kanbun as analogous to writing in a foreign language. In an 1879 essay, he compared the low level of scholarship in Western languages with the high level of Japanese sinology, writing, quote, "How many Japanese are there who can write Western prose with precision and elegance or produce their poems with delicate skill? Certainly it is true that the Japanese who can freely wield a brush in this way, as a Japanese sinological scholar writes the poetry and prose of China, are few indeed." So is this all just a post-Meiji phenomenon? What about during the Edo period, safely before the rise of nationalism? What light can early modern remarks on poetry shed on this question? Take the example of Gion Nankai, who states matter-of-factly in Shiketsu, his popular treatise for aspiring Sinitic poets, that, quote, "Sinitic poetry is written in the words and script of China." Such linguistic consciousness was a basic point of departure for many practitioners of Sinitic verse in the Edo period. A basic sense of the linguistic otherness of Sinitic was behind a question much debated among Sinitic poets at the time. how or even whether to incorporate Japanese proper nouns into Sinitic poetry. Emura Hokkai offered a substantial consideration of this topic in a 1783 treatise. He began a section devoted to the subject of toponyms by stating simply that, quote, Sinitic prose and poetry is the enterprise of China. For this reason, although Japanese toponyms sound quite nice in Waka, he argued, there is something basically forced and unnatural about the people of our land inserting the toponyms of our land into their Sinitic poems, for Sinitic poetry and writings are the enterprise of the Chinese people. Hokkai's assertion here of a potentially discordant incompatibility between Japanese toponyms and Sinitic poetry had motivated earlier poets to compile elaborate reference guides listing suitable Sinitic equivalents of Japanese toponyms. The paratextual matter of such guides clearly indicates the sense of linguistic otherness that animated the project. Consider Usami Shinsui's preface to the popular Tōsō Kai, Compendium of Sinitic Stylings of Japanese Toponyms, which observes, quote, in that land of China with its literary efflorescence, literary figures and men of talent nevertheless find it difficult to refine their diction. How much more is this true in our nation of Japan, where the language is not the same as that land, and we use the phrases and words of that land to provide literary ornament? The third category of shiwa in Fujikawa's typology are remarks on poetry that explicate obscure or otherwise noteworthy poetic diction. Perhaps the best known example is Katsugen Shiwa, published in 1787 by the Tendai Buddhist priest Rikunyo, which provides the author's consideration of Sinitic vocabulary in over 800 entries. The preface to the volume, written by Rikunyo's poetic associate Daiten, indicates the linguistic consciousness that animates the text, revealing an unmistakable conception of Sinitic as a foreign language. Daiten writes, quote, investigating and elucidating the meaning of words constitutes the beginning of study. How much more is this true in the case of a Japanese who studies Chinese? It is simply impossible to read Rikunyo's wide-ranging remarks in this text without concluding that he fundamentally conceives of kanji and kanbun as texts written in a foreign language, albeit one that he had devoted his life to studying. In discussing the rhyme categories of ancient style poems, for example, Rikunyo observes, even Chinese people are unfamiliar with ancient poetics, to say nothing of Japanese. Or consider his discussion of this term, zhigeitan, a mysterious term from Wang Xizhi's calligraphy copybooks. From context, it must mean some sort of fruit-producing vine, but it is unclear what plant it refers to specifically. Rikunyo quotes one Chinese source as stating simply that it is unknown what this refers to, which prompts him to remark, if even people in China don't know what it means, it stands to reason that people here wouldn't know either. Occasionally, Rikunyo approaches the problem of linguistic expression in Sinitic poetry from the other side, asking not what a given term in a continental poem means, but instead how a given Japanese term might be expressed in Sinitic. In one section, for example, Rikunyo ponders what might be the proper literary Sinitic term for an uchishiki, the triangular cloth apron placed upon a Buddhist altar. He states matter-of-factly that he does not know the proper term in Sinitic, but gives two possibilities that he has encountered in texts by Japanese priests, which you see here, Jōfu Shippoku or Jōwei Takui. The first of these, Rikunyo notes, he saw in one biography of a Japanese Buddhist priest with a gloss written on the side reading Uchishiki. Rikunyo calls this gloss a yaku, or a translation. Similar entries find Rikunyo musing about what Sinitic word best expresses a souvenir, Japanese omiyage, from a trip, or how to refer to the Japanese heated hearth known as a kotatsu, or what is the proper Sinitic term for a yanagigori wicker case. Each of these terms has an accepted, widely used sinographic orthography in Japan. But Rikunyo was not interested in such local conventions. Rather, he sought to discover terms attested in Chinese texts, such as the poetry of Sudongpo or Yang Guanli that he adduced in these examples, that would be intelligible to a broader sinospheric readership. Yamada Suiyu's 1862 Suiyuken Shiwa is a late Edo text that is heavily indebted to Rikunyo's Katsugen Shiwa. The very first matter Suiyu takes up in this treatise is the proper Sinitic term for the kajika, a small frog with a truly delightful call, They're actually YouTube videos featuring the Kajika, which I recommend highly to you. It'll blow your mind. Anyway, Sui U notes that the frog has long been celebrated by waka poets, but laments that Japan's kanshi poets have not written about the frog and its enchanting call because the proper Sinitic term is not widely known. Again, the issue is not the existence of sinographs corresponding to kajika, for there was an accepted sinographic orthography for kajika within Japan, but rather ignorance about what sinographs might indicate the frog to sinospheric poets outside Japan. We might imagine that this conception of the foreignness of literary Sinitic came only in the wake of Ogyu Sorai's famous insistence in the early 18th century that Japanese scholars directly confront the foreignness of literary Sinitic texts. In the 1715 Yakubun Sente, for example, he argues that the ubiquitous practice of Kanbun Kundoku is nothing more than interlingual translation, cautioning that Japanese learners so accustomed to employing it might fail to fully appreciate that, quote, our land has its own language and China has its own language. But even before Sorai, and even among those who did not share his disdain for kundoku approaches, one does not have to look far to find statements by Japanese intellectuals that clearly situate literary Sinitic as a foreign language. In Bunkun, the Neo-Confucian scholar Kaibara Ekiken attributes the difficulties Japanese readers face in reading canonical literary Sinitic texts to the fact that the language is foreign. Quote, the letters and the words of the teachings in the four books and the five classics are unfamiliar to the eyes and ears of our Japanese people. By contrast, quote, Japanese songs are in the language of our land, and thus the words are easy to read and the meaning easy to apprehend. In the same text, Ekiken also adduces the foreignness of the Chinese language in his dismissal of Japanese efforts to compose Sinitic poetry. But even enthusiastic composers of Sinitic poetry, such as Arai Hakuseki, clearly understood literary Sinitic as a foreign language. In the time that remains, I'd like to very briefly discuss two shiwa that focus specifically on the issue of the sound of Sinitic verse. The first is Shiritsu by Akazawa Ichido. Shiritsu may be translated as the rules for Sinitic poetry and was published in 1833 while the author was still alive. Akazawa was a scholar originally from Sanuki who spent much of his life living in Kyoto. His Shiritsu is an example of the first category in Fujikawa Hideo's typology, a treatise focused on addressing practical matters of composition. Yet Akazawa Ichido's text is also similar in some ways to the second category of the typology, for it is not really introductory in nature, and it is also organized to make several particular arguments about the importance of sound to Sinitic poetry. Consider this statement from the text. Sinitic poetry takes sound as its principal consideration. A work lacking harmonious sounds fails to become a poem. Sinitic poems are composed of lines of just five or seven words. The language of the Chinese people makes regular use of rhyme and distinguishes light and heavy sounds. For this reason, their poems, while there are of course differences in terms of quality, can sound harmonious and be worth recitation. Those who aspire to write Sinitic poems must put themselves in the place of those people and learn from specific dynasties. What are Han and Wei poems? What are Six Dynasties or Tang or Song? They must understand what is distinctive about Li Bai and Du Fu, about Shan Yue and Song Yu, about Yuan Zhen and Bai Jue. Only by grasping each of these clearly and distinguishing their tones carefully is one able to enter the realm of excellence in his own compositions. Akamatsu Ichido's insistence on the importance of sound in thinking about Sinitic poetry is clear from the contents of Shiritsu, which includes several discussions of topics focused on poetry's aural dimensions. The sections on tone, rhyme, parallelism, and so forth are a major portion of the text, and a principal focus of the section on methods involves concerns of sound. Ichido is clear that the Japanese poet of Sinitic forms faced particular challenges. He writes, when Nagasaki Chinese read the poems of those who are esteemed as great Sinitic poets in our land, they inevitably dismiss them and don't approve of their works. The reason is because these poets don't know about sound. Imagine having an unsophisticated person compose a song. Even if the meaning might be clear, it still couldn't be set to music on a samisen. The reason is none other than the unsophisticated person doesn't understand tune and melody. While Japanese Sinitic poets might appeal to the eye, he argued, they were not always appealing orally. He goes on to extend the metaphor and observes that it's hard enough for Japanese to write passable songs in Japanese, to say nothing of doing so in the foreign language of literary Sinitic. Nevertheless, while Ichido is clear that the Japanese poet of Sinitic forms faced particular challenges, he felt confident that thorough knowledge of rhyme patterns, techniques, and rhythmic structures, those that he focused on in Shiritsu, that this was the essential skill that Japanese needed in order to take their place in composition of Sinitic poetry. In the text, he even felt confident to venture corrections occasionally on the lexical choices of UN poets. Whereas Akazawa Ichido deferred to the opinion of contemporary Chinese in questions of sound, a very different response to the relevance of knowledge of contemporary spoken Chinese is seen in the final text that I would like to discuss, Ono Senzel's Shayu Shiritsuron, Debates on Tonal Prosody Among Friends. The text consists of a letter Ono Senzo wrote to Rai Sanyo, his teacher in Sinitic poetry, and the responses of Sanyo and several other scholars and poets. Only one of the letters is dated from 1820, but they all seem to have been written around the same time. The text was only published half a century later in the early Meiji period when it was given a preface by Rai Sanyo's son, as well as the Qing literatus Chen Manshou. Ono's letter begins with a simple question about tonal prosody, the rules of alternating level and oblique tones that govern composition of regulated verse octaves and quatrains. Ono notes that he has often had Sanyo correct his poems, relying on his teacher to identify mistakes in the tonal prosody patterns, but that he has begun to wonder. He thinks, it is generally agreed that the rules of tonal prosody developed at a time when poems were still sung to musical accompaniment. Early Tang poets such as Shen Quanxi and Song Zhiwan developed the alternating patterns of tonal prosody to create euphony and facilitate musical accompaniment. But now, the way of reciting poetry and song has already been abandoned even in China, as you, Master, once pointed out to me. And yet, even today, people fastidiously observe these rules. I don't understand why this should be. After all, it is because of the food in his cauldron that a cook labors to make a harmonious blend of the five flavors. But now that the way of reciting through song has been abandoned, to preserve the rules of tonal prosody is like worrying about the five flavors when there is no food in the cauldron. This doubt leads Ono to wonder if some other set of rules, beyond those consolidated as poems in the recent style by Shen Quanxi and Song Zhiwan, might also prove euphonious. In his response, Dai Sanyo, recently returned from his travels to Western Japan, argues against mastering contemporary Chinese pronunciation. He describes his encounter with Chinese merchants based in Nagasaki and with interpreters of spoken Chinese about whom he has a decidedly low opinion. He writes, I think that studying Chinese pronunciation is not worth the effort and that the eight faults are not worth worrying about. In other words, Sanyo has a strikingly different view about the relevance of contemporary Chinese pronunciation to questions about Sinitic poetic practice. He forcefully rejects the recent fashionability of spoken Chinese study. And yet this does not mean that Sanyo had any doubts about the fundamental foreignness of Sinitic. He goes on to elaborate an argument about linguistic change over time that ties particular forms that are dominant at any moment to changes in the temper of the times. he articulates this idea of the trend of the chimes, noting that Li Bai, Du Fu, Han Yu, and Su Shi, even if one had their abilities, or if one had their abilities, it would be possible to create something older style. And then noting, even among Chinese people, if this is the case, needless to say, with the situation in Japan, where we use their language to express our feelings, he says at the bottom. So I think I'm over the time, so I'll just quickly wrap up. The remaining letters in this Shiwa offer a variety of views on the question of how to conceptualize sound in Sinitic poetry. On the fine points, they clearly diverge, but as we see here in Dai Sanyo's response, there's also an emerging consensus that highlights the key factor of linguistic change over time. This assertion created a potential parallel between present-day Japanese and their Sinospheric counterparts, and also helped to support arguments that buttressed the validity of Japanese evaluations of Sinitic prosody. Yet, as Sanjo's argument here indicates, such an awareness, such a validation of Japanese evaluation of Sinitic was in no way incompatible with his recognition of the basic linguistic distinction of Sinitic from Japanese. Thank you very much.